This morning's scripture reading is taken from 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16 through chapter 5, verse 10. Second Corinthians chapter 4, starting with verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose, and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come. Therefore, we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. We live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and we prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So we make it our goal to please Him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. About 11 years ago, my husband Walter and I were planning our move to Boston. We had just graduated from seminary in Vancouver, Canada, and Walter had chosen to enroll in a PhD program at Harvard. I had not yet figured out my next step. We decided to take a vacation, and we were fortunate enough to find a beachfront home on Vancouver Island, which was owned by Christians who gave it out to pastors. We decided to begin our vacation with a 24-hour retreat of silence to give each other the time and the space just to be with God. At the house, there was a glass-enclosed porch that looked directly out onto the ocean. I sat down in a very comfortable chair, and in the distance, I saw a small rocky island, and the ocean waves were crashing against the island. I sat there, just awed at the view, and thinking about how this was a picture of the power of God, that the waves were constantly moving, but never changing. And the rocks, which seemed so solid, nevertheless were being shaped by the relentless power of the waves. So I was enjoying the view, enjoying these thoughts. And then I got thirsty. So I got up and went to the kitchen, got something to drink. And when I returned, I found Walter there, nestled comfortably in my chair. Now, normally I would have made some sweet comment like, hey, my chair! but it was a retreat of silence, and so I couldn't really do that. And I could have tapped him on the shoulder and kind of motioned for him to go away, but I kind of felt like that wasn't quite the spirit of this retreat. And so I plopped down in the chair next to me and went to go look at my view, and there was the ocean, and there was the island, but I couldn't see the waves crashing against the island. So I moved my chair this way and that way, but no matter how I moved it, I couldn't see the interesting part of the island with the waves crashing. By this point, retreat of silence or no retreat of silence, I was starting to get frustrated. I was beginning to fume a little bit. And then I started to realize that this is a picture of our lives. Walter had a clear view of what was going on. He knew we were going to Boston. He was going to spend the next many, many years immersed in the study of the Old Testament. And my view was cut off. I mean, I knew we were going to Boston, but I had no idea what was going to happen there. What was I going to do? Who was I going to be? I couldn't see what was happening. And then Hebrews 11:1 came to my mind. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And I realized that although I couldn't see the waves crashing against the island, it would be utter foolishness for me to say, well, therefore, they no longer were crashing. I could hear the waves, but I couldn't see them. But I knew that they existed. In the same way, Walter had a more direct view of what was going on, but that didn't mean that God was only at work in his life and not in mine. And I realized that my challenge, as well as my call, was to have faith to believe that even though I couldn't see what was coming, that I could trust that God was at work, that God knew what he was doing, and that I really could put my faith in him. God was teaching me that faith brings true sight, that believing is seeing. And that's what this morning's passage is about believing being seeing. We often hear the phrase, seeing is believing. And for some things, it really is true that you've got to see it in order to believe it. But for the most part, our vision is imperfect, and we need the faith to give us true sight. Now, Paul wrote 2 Corinthians in large part to defend his apostolic ministry. Paul had established the church in Corinth, but then there are these so-called super apostles that had come to Corinth with these letters of recommendation, and they had persuaded some of the Corinthian believers that Paul's claim to apostleship was just fraught with deficiencies. Primary among their arguments was that the catalog of Paul's suffering invalidated his ministry. The contention was that if someone was truly blessed by God, there was no way that he would keep encountering suffering upon suffering. But Paul vigorously disagrees, and he turns his suffering into a teaching opportunity about how to view life and death and how to live. In this morning's passage, Paul contrasts the now with the eternal. We start by seeing the now. At the end of chapter 4, Paul talks about how now we are outwardly wasting away, but our troubles are light and momentary, because the things that are seen are temporary. Chapter 5 explains that the earthly tent of our bodies will be destroyed, but in the interim, we groan and are burdened. Now, when Paul talks about wasting away, he surely has in mind all the suffering he has experienced as an apostle of Jesus Christ. And he doesn't downplay the suffering in any way. In fact, at the beginning of the letter, in chapter 1, Paul says, we were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. And in chapter 6, Paul lists out troubles, hardships and distresses, beatings, imprisonments and riots, hard work, sleepless nights, and hunger. In chapter 11, he goes into great detail. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day on the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country. I mean, the list just keeps going on, and just even reading it makes us tired. Paul's difficulties are, in fact, quite difficult. Now, if you and I were to endure even one line of what Paul did, would we describe our troubles as momentary and light? I don't think so. We might maybe have the ability to call it temporary, but it's hard to consider them to be light or insignificant. I mean, you know how it is. When you're in the midst of a difficulty, it can be completely all-consuming. Even something as little as a toothache can ruin your day or your week, because you can be you're consumed by the pain and trying to figure out how you can get rid of this pain. We all have firsthand experience about how all-consuming this difficulty is. Whether we have physical pain or an emotional struggle, we know that these things can take over our lives and prevent us from functioning properly. And then Paul is saying, in comparison to our natural reaction to difficulty, there will be a mind-blowing, all-consuming encounter with God's glory that will be so compelling that it will shove out any of our preoccupations with the difficulties. We will see that what we experience now is not only momentary, but it really is light when we compare it with the eternal weight of glory. Secondly, Paul describes our earthly tent as something that will certainly be destroyed. Early Greek philosophers often described the physical body as a mortal tent, temporarily inhabited by the immortal soul. Now, this led readily to a dualism between body and soul. And in fact, some of the Corinthians had been under the misimpression that what was done in the body really had nothing to do with what was going on in the soul. And that's why in 1 Corinthians 6, Paul had to make it clear that we are to honor God with our physical bodies. Now, Paul in 2 Corinthians here is not contradicting his earlier teaching to the Corinthians. His usage of the tent image is likely not from the Greek philosophers, but more from his experience as a tent maker and as a Jew. The contrast is between a tent that is temporary and a dwelling place that is permanent. Think about it. People who use tents actually live elsewhere. They are using the tent as a temporary shelter. Paul most certainly made lots of tents for all the visitors who poured into Corinth for the Isthmian Games. And as a Jew, Paul would have found this imagery even more rich because his forebears traveled in tents on the way to the Promised Land. The presence of God went with them in the tabernacle, which is a special kind of tent. So the Israelites' tent and God's tabernacle were reminders that this is not the Israelites' true home. And it kept the Israelites looking forward to the Promised Land, to a more permanent dwelling place, first here on earth, but ultimately in heaven. Hebrews 11 says that by faith, Abraham made his home in the Promised Land like a stranger in the foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Paul is using the image of tents to reinforce the contrast between what is now and what is eternal. Now we are outwardly wasting away, and the earthly tents which we see are only temporary. Therefore, we groan. We groan because the suffering is real, and we want it to end. As verse 4 says, we groan and are burdened because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed with the heavenly dwelling. Romans 8 also corroborates this. We ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. This groaning is actually a good thing. It is not a self-focused complaining. It is a hope-filled anticipation of what is to come. Through faith, we see that what is now is hard and difficult, but it is also temporary and light. For what we see now is not our permanent home. What is your vision of the now? Have you settled into life on earth, seeing it not as a temporary earthly tent, but as the sum of your existence, your true home? I mean, some of us lead lives that are pretty comfortable, and it's easy to forget that each of us is, in fact, dying. That this life and the present moment are not all there is to live for. In a very real sense, we are all on death row, waiting for a death that is inescapable. It is so easy to get caught up in all the details of our lives, to be swamped by the lengthy to-do lists that dominate our daily existence. And we need to ask God for eyes to see the now for what it is, hard, but temporary and light. Some of us, on the other hand, are all too familiar with suffering. We feel daily that outwardly we are wasting away, that our bodies are weak. Whether it is because of physical disease or disability, or inner struggles with depression and loneliness, we groan. And when life seems unbearable and we despair even of life, we too need to ask God for eyes to see the now for what it truly is. Hard and difficult, but light and temporary. Seeing the now as light and temporary is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin has to do with seeing the eternal. Now, Paul doesn't just ask people to achieve some type of stoicism in which you try to overcome your emotions and somehow persuade yourself that the things that are happening don't have any effect on me. No, our vision of the now is based upon reality, not just our perception of reality. Our vision of the now is complemented by our vision of the eternal. The end of chapter 4 says that outwardly we are wasting away, but inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us a glory that far outweighs them all. The things that are unseen are eternal, Paul says. And chapter 5 goes on to describe a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. We long to be clothed with this heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. Note, first of all, that Paul's primary contrast is between the now and the eternal. It's easy for us to think that the contrast is between now and later, that now on earth we suffer, but later in heaven everything's going to be perfect. Now life is hard, but later everything will be made right. And it's true that earth and heaven represent two different realities. But Paul here is not really focusing on time or space. He's focusing on quality. So the contrast is not so much a sequential one between what is already now and what will come later. Instead, the emphasis is on the difference between what is temporarily now and what is permanently eternal. You see, eternity is not something that just starts after you die. Eternity has already begun. In 2 Corinthians 4:16, Paul says that outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. It doesn't say that outwardly we are wasting away, but if we wait long enough, well then eventually we will be renewed inwardly. When we're in the midst of some type of difficulty, it is very helpful to have a hope for the future. But it is even more helpful and more meaningful to have hope in the present. And that is exactly what we can have. Inwardly, we are already being renewed day by day. This means that we don't have to wait until later in order to find peace and joy now. We don't need to wait for later in order to not be consumed by our pain or our difficulties. We can be renewed day by day, moment by moment. And just how are we renewed? Colossians 3 uses this term to describe the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. And it's the same term from the familiar passage in Romans 12, in which we are exhorted not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. We are renewed as we train ourselves to see the eternal. It happens by what is described in verse 18. We fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Now, the NIV translates verse 18 as though fixing our eyes on the unseen is the conclusion from verse 17. By placing the word so at the beginning of verse 18, the paragraph reads something like this. Because our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal weight of glory that far outweighs them all, therefore, we should fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. The so leads you to think that the reason for fixing your eyes on the unseen is because our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal weight of glory. Now, this is one possible translation of the Greek construction, but I think the better choice is made by other translations, like the English Standard Version or the NASB, who use as or while we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. And I like the choice of as or while rather than so because I think it makes an important point. You see, light and momentary troubles don't always achieve for us an eternal weight of glory. There is absolutely nothing that is inherently good about troubles that sanctifies us or produces something good. Sometimes suffering just makes us bitter or angry or resentful. And if we fix our eyes on what is seen, I can guarantee that no matter how light or momentary the troubles are, we will become embittered. It is only as or while we fix our eyes on what is unseen that we understand that our light and momentary troubles will and is producing in us an eternal weight of glory. Therefore, we need to train our eyes to see the eternal. Pastor and author Eugene Peterson tells a story about his grandson Andrew when he was an infant. Eugene had the opportunity to be with his grandson and his grandson's mother, Lynn. And Eugene watched with great attentiveness as Andrew was perfecting his crawl and playing with a tennis ball. And as Andrew delightedly and repeatedly chased the ball, Eugene marveled over his grandson's coordination, started thinking about Andrew's future sports career and all these things. And after about 10 or 15 minutes, the ball that Andrew was chasing rolled behind some furniture, and Andrew sat back and then looked around for something else to do. And all of a sudden, all of Eugene's hopes turned into fears. What's wrong with Andrew? Why did he have such a short attention span? So he asked Andrew's mom, what's wrong with Andrew? And Lynn, not even bothering to look up from the book that she was reading, simply replied, Andrew has not yet acquired object permanence. What does that mean? Lynn said, well, it means that if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. Eugene paused, letting it sink in. And he said, oh, I've got a congregation like that. We are a congregation that needs object permanence. We need God permanence. We need to know that even if we can't see something, it still can exist. Even if we can't see the waves crashing against the island, they are still there. Even if we cannot see the eternal weight of glory, it really is there, and it is eternal. Even if we cannot see the living God, He is there. And from everlasting to everlasting, He is God. We must train our eyes to see the eternal. A second image Paul uses to describe the eternal is our heavenly dwelling, the building from God, an eternal house in heaven not built by human hands. There are multiple references to a heavenly dwelling in the New Testament, and most of them are corporate rather than individual. Jesus said in John 14, "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am." Ephesians chapter 2 talks about how the church is God's building. Paul writes, "In him the whole building is joined together and rises to become a holy temple in the Lord. And in him you too are being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit." The building is not made of mortar and brick. Rather, according to the Apostle Peter, it is made of living stones, the people of God. Now, many of us have a rather indistinct picture of heaven. Often there's some vague notion of having wings and playing harps and hanging out on clouds or something like that. And maybe some of us think of it as being in the presence of God. But that, too, is sometimes hard to visualize. Whatever our view, I'd venture to say that many of us don't have a picture of heaven that is particularly compelling. Few of us are really in a rush to get to heaven because our view of it is so insipid and boring, frankly. I used to feel the same way, but that was until my father-in-law passed away 13 years ago. Suddenly, heaven was no longer an abstract concept. Heaven was the place where I would be reunited with Walter's dad. This completely revolutionized my understanding of heaven. It also gave me a real longing for heaven. It will be the great family reunion with God our Father as the centerpiece. Heaven is a place where my daughter Naomi will no longer be inhibited by Down syndrome, and she will finally get to meet her wonderful grandfather. In that city with foundations, we will meet Father Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and countless heroes of faith, both sung and unsung. What is your conception of the heavenly dwelling? How often do you think about the things that are eternal? We need to train our eyes to look at what is unseen and eternal. And we can learn from the example of Fanny Crosby, that great hymn writer who became blind at 6 weeks of age at the hands of a quack doctor. She went on to write over 9,000 hymns, one of which we will sing later in the service. One day at a Bible conference here in Massachusetts, famous evangelist Dwight L. Moody asked Ms. Crosby to give her testimony. After hesitating a bit, she stood and said, "There is one hymn I have written which has never been published. I call it My Soul's Poem. Sometimes when I am troubled, I repeat it to myself, for it brings comfort to my heart." Here are the first two stanzas. "Someday the silver cord will break, and I, no more as now, shall sing. But oh, the joy when I shall wake within the palace of the King. And I shall see him face to face and tell the story, saved by grace. And I shall see him face to face and tell the story, saved by grace. Someday my earthly house will fall. I cannot tell how soon 'twill be. But this I know, my all in all has now a place in heaven for me. And I shall see him face to face and tell the story, saved by grace. And I shall see him face to face and tell the story, saved by grace." Her soul's poem. I think we all need a soul poem to bring comfort to our hearts when we are troubled, a soul poem to give us object permanence, God permanence, that trains our eyes to see the eternal, something that breaks us out of our self-absorbed, mundane existence and helps us to fix our eyes on that which is unseen and eternal. To recap thus far, faith enables us to see the now as hard but temporary and light. And faith also trains our eyes to see the eternal. And after the various contrasts between the now and the eternal, Paul asserts in verse 5, "It is God who made us for this very purpose and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come." Now we have the Spirit as a deposit. We don't have just the promise of the Spirit. We actually have the Spirit himself with us now. The Spirit marks us as belonging to God and guarantees our inheritance. The Spirit is already at work in us and for us. The eternal impinges upon the now and transforms the way we live, renewing us day by day. And all this leads to the final point, which is believing is seeing the now in light of the eternal. We have seen the now, we have seen the eternal, but what we must do is bring it all together and learn to see the now in light of the eternal. When we see that what we experience now is difficult, but temporary and light, but imbued with the eternal, our perspective on life is completely altered. We can no longer live on the basis of what we just see. More precisely, we are no longer content to live on the basis of what we see. After making repeated comparisons between the present and the eternal, in the remainder of the passage, Paul talks about this confidence that Christians have. According to Hebrews 13:6, "With this confidence we declare, 'The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me?'" But the conclusion to all these comparisons and confidence may actually surprise you. In verses 9 and 10, Paul writes, "So we make it our goal to please him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad." The judgment seat of Christ. Sounds a little scary, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds even more ominous in Greek. It's called the bema. Sounds a bit kind of like a bomb or something. I mean, it sounds like something that would really undermine our confidence. not something that would flow through confidence. In context, it seems clear that this judgment seat is not the great white throne of judgment for all people. It is a judgment for believers only. Salvation is not on the line here. Rather, Paul is reprising his teaching from 1 Corinthians 3 about how Christians will receive reward or suffer loss based upon their actions. Remember that in verse 5, Paul has just said that the Spirit was given to us as a deposit, and it guarantees our inheritance. The Spirit was given to us by grace through faith, and it makes our salvation secure. And so we do not fear the judgment seat of Christ, but instead, knowing that we will have to give an account, we make it our earnest desire to please Him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. Paul's point is that the things we do or don't do in the body really are relevant, and therefore our hope about eternity should translate to obedience now. Several years prior to writing 2 Corinthians, Paul had appeared before the judgment seat of Gallio, who was proconsul of Achaia. You can read about this Bema in Acts 18, and you can actually see the Bema in the ruins of modern-day Corinth in southern Greece. Acts 18 describes how the Jews dragged Paul to Gallio's Bema, bringing charges against Paul for persuading people to worship God in ways that were contrary to the law. But Gallio refuses to render judgment, saying that their concerns were religious and had nothing to do with his court. Whereupon the Jews, dissatisfied by this, turn on Paul's colleague Sosthenes, the synagogue ruler, and they beat him in front of the court. But Gallio does nothing about it. Our attitude toward a bema is dependent upon two things. The first is who sits upon it. If an unjust judge sits upon the bema, then we do well to fear it, because you do not know what kind of whimsical judgment the judge will render. But if Christ is seated upon the bema, then you know that His judgment will be trustworthy and good. The second factor that determines our attitude is our expectations. If we are guilty and are afraid of being found out, then the bema is something that is very scary, whether the judge is just or unjust. But if we are innocent, then we look forward to the bema as a place where we will be vindicated and justice will be served. Think of the inmate on death row who finds out that new DNA evidence has been found that will prove his innocence. He can't wait to get to that bema so that he can be declared innocent and be given a new life. This is the attitude that Paul has. He had been brought before the bema of Gallio, and now he is being brought before the court of public opinion in Corinth. The super apostles had him on trial, accusing him of not really belonging to Christ. But Paul knows that at the Bema, at the judgment seat of Christ, he will be vindicated for all the things done while in the body. All the accusations of his enemies will be silenced. And Paul looks forward to that day and instructs us to live with confidence in light of that coming judgment. And so we must choose. Are we going to expend all of our energies in order to try to gain approval in the court of public opinion here on earth? Or are we willing to be accused of being closed-minded, narrow, deceived, for the sake of Christ? Are we going to fix our eyes on what is seen, or are we going to follow the example of Moses? From Hebrews 11 again. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God, rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded his grace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. Moses chose to be mistreated rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin that were for a short time. The same Greek term that Paul uses in 2 Corinthians 4:18 to describe the things that are seen. They are temporary. Moses suffered disgrace for the sake of Christ because he was looking forward to his reward and because he saw him who is invisible. Friends, God is invisible, but he is not absent. The things that are unseen are not visible, but they are real and enduring. Therefore, it is not foolishness to forego the pleasures of sin, because they are merely temporary. They don't truly satisfy. They leave us merely hungering for more. It is not foolishness to place your faith in God and to trust Him. Just because you cannot see something doesn't mean that it ceases to exist. God is real, and our reward is very real. Therefore, we should make it our goal to please Him in all that we do. We should spend our lives for the ultimate treasure of being with Christ in His Father's house. Suffering, death, and judgment. This brief passage in 2 Corinthians touches upon three big taboos in our modern culture. Our culture wants us to avoid suffering, deny death, and scoff at any notion of judgment. And we all too easily get squeezed into the mold of this world. But faith grants us sight. It grants us the ability to see the now as difficult, but light and momentary. Faith trains our eyes to see the eternal, to know that the eternal has already begun and will endure. Last May, my dear friend Bridget Slotemaker was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She was 35 years old and pregnant with her second child. Some of you knew Bridget personally. She and her husband Steve met and married at Park Street. Their daughter Gracie was baptized here about 3 years ago before they moved to Oregon. After we got the news last May, many of you prayed earnestly for her and her family through all the ups and downs of her battle with cancer. We praised God together for the birth of her 1 pound, two ounce baby. And by the way, Chloe just recently celebrated her 1 year birthday, and she is doing quite well. Praise be to God. But Bridget knew that she was dying. But this did not cause her to despair. Instead, she consistently spoke of a peace that she had that kind of surprised her. She took no credit for having any greater faith than anybody else. Rather, she sensed in a very real way that God was renewing her spirit day by day, even while outwardly she was quickly wasting away. In an open letter read at a tribute concert here last June, Bridget wrote, "I have felt God with me this entire journey like I never have before. I have felt scared, and I have felt lots of sadness. But surprisingly to myself, I have never felt angry or forsaken. I know He did not cause this. He has given me a peace that keeps me going and has wiped away every fear." Bridget's illness and her death just 3 short months later trained our sight to focus on the eternal. Friends who knew her from small groups or work or school met regularly to pray for her. And when people asked her or Steve how to help, their consistent answer was, "If you do not yet know the Lord Jesus, consider a relationship with Him." I spoke with Bridget a few days before she died. Do you want to know the main topic of our conversation? It wasn't the pain that she was undergoing. It wasn't the fears that she was experiencing. She wanted advice on how she should respond to a friend of hers who was asking more questions about God. Bridget was more concerned with her friend's eternal relationship with God than she was with her own impending death. This was not denial. This was having the faith to see that if this earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. This was seeing now in light of the eternal. Let us pray. God, we ask that You would give us eyes that would be able to see truly, that You would help us to see beyond the difficulties that we experience right now, to take these difficulties to You, and to help You, to ask You to help us to transform our vision, to help us to know that they really are light and momentary, though they are difficult and cause us to despair of life. Give us eyes to see the eternal, to have object permanence, to have God permanence, to know that even when You seem invisible, when You seem silent, when You seem distant, Help us to know that you actually are present with us, that you are active, that you are renewing our spirit day by day. Help us to fix our eyes not on what is unseen, not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, to know that what is unseen is eternal. Give us the confidence to live in a way that brings you glory and honor and that results in our joy and peace. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.